conversations with my ministerial colleagues over the years on how we arrive at our sermon themes, I've noticed something of a consensus exists when it comes to the category of sermon topic most often avoided. Hands down, the prize in that area goes to Mother's Day. Or more specifically, a sermon about mothers on Mother's Day. Why this is so may not seem all that apparent at first. You've got to think, how could you possibly go on talking about mothers? Well, there are ways. Praise mothers too much and too uncritically, and you invite flack from anyone who has some unpleasant mommy issues they don't wish to be reminded of, except maybe when discussing them with their therapist. But if you speak in any way to those kinds of mommy issues, you invite flack from those who don't have them, figure they don't need to hear about them because their mothers were fine and wonderful. Thank you very much. And what about those women who, by chance or circumstance, aren't mothers? Are you missing them by extolling the virtues of motherhood? And how about those moms who are maybe less than thrilled about being moms or felt they haven't quite cut it as a mother and don't want to hear about how great it all is? And if you're going to talk about traditional family structure mothers, shouldn't you also acknowledge and validate single moms, moms in same-sex unions, and all the other variations on motherhood that are out there? And on it goes. So what may seem like a pretty safe subject on the surface becomes, upon closer inspection, a veritable minefield. And I'm one of those people who tends to go with the idea that the best way to avoid a no-win situation is to not put yourself in one in the first place. So clearly the path of least resistance here would be to skip the Mother's Day sermon altogether, work in a few motherly references or tributes as another part of the service, which we have already done to our great credit. And this has been, for me, in fact, the road most taken when it comes to the second Sunday of May. But this year, I decided to take my cue from Robert Frost, take the road less traveled by, and see where it may take us and lead us. And the first place I'd like to start is in the history. And with two stories about three women. For they are two stories on how we have come to have a Mother's Day observance in the first place. Now, on the surface, they may appear to be somewhat contradictory, and they're sometimes presented as such, but upon closer inspection, I think they're more closely related than one might realize or think. But indeed, they are the stories of two very different kinds of women. Different when it comes to their social status, to their level of education, and to their place in history. But as I hope to show, they also have a kind of convergence if seen in a certain light. And they are the stories of Julia Ward Howe and Anna Marie Jarvis. Each of these women is credited with the founding of Mother's Day. And in ways I hope I can explain, they each deserve their share of the credit, with neither one of them getting all of it. With this being a Unitarian Universalist congregation, I'm going to guess that the name Julia Ward Howe has a little more name recognition to it. After all, she was one of us. So I'll start with her. Born in 1819 into a New York City family of comfort and ease. Father was a rather well-to-do and successful banker. She was not born a Unitarian. She was raised in a family with a very strict Calvinist theology and ethic. And yet even by her teenage years, Julia had shown a certain amount of precociousness, was questioning her whole religious framework, which is what led a number of us here. And at age 21, she married a very prominent Boston physician and Unitarian named Samuel Ridley Howe. And she and Samuel became a part of that pre-Civil War Boston Unitarian Transcendentalist circle that kind of coalesced around Waldo Emerson and Thoreau and some of those other folks. And they were very much influenced by the preaching of their Unitarian minister, the Reverend Theodore Parker, who was also an ardent abolitionist. And this caused Julia herself to become very devoted to the abolitionist cause, and she wanted to take some public stands and sort of go out there and be an out front type of abolitionist. Her husband, however liberal his religion may have been, was much more of a traditionalist. He felt that she should be staying at home and helping to raise the six children that they have, And for they had, for this and other reasons, their marriage was not always a completely happy one. But by the time the Civil War broke out, both Samuel and Julia have become involved in the work of an organization called the Sanitary Commission, which is the forerunner organization of what is now the Red Cross. They tended to war wounded. So the Boston doctor and his activist-minded wife worked together. By now, Julia had become a published poet. She had some of her poems published, I think, in Atlantic Monthly, Harper's, and other publications like that. And while it was visiting an encampment of soldiers in the Union Army near Washington, D.C. in 1862, and seeing them preparing to go into battle, Julia Ward Howe wrote the words to the battle hymn of the Republic. And it reflected her very fierce abolitionist sentiments, to the point that she wrote of how the Lord himself, behind the Union cause, trampling out vintages and wielding a terrible swift sword and loosening faithful lightning on the Union's behalf. Well, this was only one, as I said, this was only one of a number of poems that she wrote and published in her day. Practically all the others have endured or have been lost into obscurity. Battle Hymn of the Republic is the one, as you know, has endured. Now, as best I can determine, Julia Ward Howe never disavowed those sentiments that she expressed and wrote about in the Battle Hymn of the Republic. But as the war went on, and as she continued to be involved in the treatment of the wounded soldiers, and saw both the physical and emotional and psychological damage that the war was inflicting upon them, in the course of all that, she gained another perspective on war and warfare that was far less exalted than the way she had portrayed it in her best-known poem and song. Even if it was being fought for ostensibly all the right reasons, what she came to see was the outcome of war in terms of its human toll. It's horrifying. And the result of all this was that as the war ended, Julia Howe became as ardent a peace activist as she had been an abolitionist, in fact, even more so. And her abolitionist sentiments then sort of opened up her consciousness and gave rise in her mind to an even wider sense of what freedom means, so she also became a very strong advocate for women's suffrage. And these combined passions of hers were what led her in the latter years of her life to rally women, mothers, and otherwise to the cause of peace. And it was out of these efforts that Julia Ward Howe, that the Julia Ward Howe version, her story of Mother's Day, came about. For in 1870, 5 years after the Civil War ended, the Franco-Prussian War broke out, and she used that occasion to attempt to rally women worldwide the cause of finding peaceful resolutions to conflicts. She was at a station where she could travel, so she actually went to Europe during some of the conferences that were being held at the outbreak of this war, and she wrote a ringing proclamation. She wanted to deliver at some of these international peace conferences in London and Paris. She was prevented from doing so by the conference organizers because she was a woman. With the means she had at her disposal, she hired her own hall, held her own rallies, read her own proclamation. And this proclamation included words that, written in that rather flowery language of the mid to late 19th century, here's some of what her Mother's Day proclamation said. Arise, arise, all women who have hearts. Our husbands will not come to us reeking of carnage for our applause. Our sons will not be taken from us to unlearn all we have taught them of charity, mercy, and patience. We, the women of one country, will be too tender of those of another country to allow our sons to be trained to injure theirs. That's only a portion of it. It's well, a long proclamation, actually. And then at another point in that, and this is a sort of a counterpoint language to what she had penned in the Battle Hymn of the Republic, she wrote, disarm, disarm, the sword of murder is not the balance of justice. Very interesting. 8 years earlier, she had been writing of the Lord's terrible, swift sword. Now she's writing about the sword of murder. Well, the reason she issued this proclamation on June 2nd, 1870, was to call for a Mother's Day for peace, she termed it. And she envisioned this as being an international peace festival that we held every year with rallying women and mothers for the cause of peace. My friend and ministerial colleague, the Reverend Forrest Church, suggests Mrs. Howe use the term Mother's Day, even though she wasn't confining it to mothers. She used the term Mother's Day, quoting him, to remind us that the whole world would be a better place if only everyone might rise to the challenge of motherhood, nurturing life, fostering peace, and giving love. She had some measure of success with this. The June 2nd date was indeed celebrated in this fashion in some American cities and in some other parts of the world. Sometimes it was done in conjunction with women's suffrage advocacy type events in the year after 1870, years after 1870. And I would certainly have to say, as I would assume most of us, if not all of us would, that the sentiments that Julia Ward Howe expresses in her proclamation are still worthy of pursuing, still worthy of celebration today. Today, more so than ever, I would say, given the state of our world. But I also have to say, trying to keep this thing historically correct, that this proclamation, these events, were not really the ones that directly led to the Mother's Day we now celebrate on the second Sunday of May. For that, we have to now turn to our second Mother's Day story. And this one is the story of two women, actually. It can get a little confusing because they both have the same name, Anna Jarvis, a mother and a daughter. We're going to start with the mother. She was born named Anna Reeves, a few years later than was Julia Ward, but she was born a world away in terms of geography and status. For Anna Reeves was born in Appalachia, in the western mountainous country of what was then the state of Virginia. She was of very modest means. Her father was a Methodist country preacher, and she in turn married another Methodist country preacher, Granville Jarvis. She had no formal education in matters of health and medicine, but Mrs. Jarvis, in the little towns that she would live there in Appalachia where her husband would be having his ministries, she became very concerned about the health and the sanitary conditions in those little towns. And so she began to organize what she called Mother's Day work clubs in these towns. Now, among the other services of these clubs, they would raise money for medicine. They would hire women to work for families in which the mothers had suffered from tuberculosis, whose children's lives had been endangered by contaminated milk or food, and tried to improve those kinds of conditions. No doubt, she saved a lot of lives because of this. And in many ways, it was very personal for her, because she and her husband lost four of their own children to childhood diseases, largely brought on by some of the less than sanitary conditions in those towns. And this fueled her passion to do what she could to save other mothers and fathers from the agony and the distress that she and her husband felt when some of these children died. And then, the Civil War. And like Julia Ward Howe, Anna Jarvis' life is shaped by that conflict also. Now, go take a little time out here for a minute. A little historical interlude of West Virginia history. So the stuff that I had to learn in the third grade, I can now put to some kind of use. As the Civil War got underway, people who were living up in the western hill country of the state of Virginia realized that their leanings and their sympathies were more with the Union than they were with the Confederacy. One of the main reasons for this is, unlike some of their fellow Virginians over in the southeast with their large plantations, the folks in northwestern Virginia were mostly dirt farmers, eking out whatever kind of a living they could from what little pieces of land that they had. Very, very few of them owned any slaves. And so fighting for an institution and for a way of life that had very little bearing on their lives came to make increasingly little sense as the war went along. And so in the course of the Civil War, the West Virginians seceded from the seceders, in other words, they seceded back from the Confederacy into the Union again, and became the 35th state in the state of West Virginia. Abraham Lincoln, as I was told numerous times, signed the document that made West Virginia a state. Okay, so much for that. Back to Ann Jarvis the Elder. When the Civil War ended, she was living in a little town called Grafton, West Virginia, where, as noted, her husband was the local Methodist minister. And since that part of the country had changed sides during the Civil War, what you had in Grafton and a number of other some of the surrounding towns, you had soldiers coming back from the war, some who had fought for the Union and some who had fought for the Confederacy, and there was a good deal of tension and a good deal of strain in those towns as these Civil War veterans came home. So Anna Jarvis decided to take action. Summer of 1865, summer after the war ended, she organized what she called in her community a Mother's Friendship Day. Purpose was to try to bring the soldiers together who fought on both sides, find some reconciliation, find some common ground, and resolve that it was time to get on with their lives. Some feared that there would be fights and violence, but the day, the event that Mrs. Jarvis put together was a success, and Mother's Friendship Day became an annual event celebrated in that part of West Virginia for a number of years hence. And like Julia Ward Howe, Mrs. Jarvis invoked the name of Mother's Day as a way of promoting peace and reconciliation for the returning veterans of the Civil War. Well, Anna's husband, Granville, died in 1902. She moved from Grafton to live with one of her daughters, also as noted, named Anna Jarvis, who was then living near Philadelphia. And the elder, Anna Marie Jarvis, died in May of 1905. And 2 years later, her daughter, Anna, went back to Grafton to lead a tribute to her mother in the Methodist Church, where her father had been the minister. And following that service, Anna Jarvis, her daughter, the younger one now, never married, never had any children of her own. Mother's Day was founded by a woman who was not a mother. She began her crusade to have a National Mother's Day recognized. And since her mother's favorite flower was the white carnation, she asked the women who were observing Mother's Day to wear white carnations. Well, she went at it for 6 years, the younger Anna Jarvis did, writing members of Congress, doing all the kinds of things she needed to do, and finally, she got President Woodrow Wilson to sign the Congressional Proclamation designating Mother's Day as an official holiday to be celebrated on the second Sunday of May. And if you ever happen to be in the town of Grafton, West Virginia, as I actually have on a few occasions, you can check out the plaque on the Methodist Church proclaiming the first Mother's Day was celebrated there on May the 12th, 1970. Now I know the Julia Ward Howe School of Mother's Day origins advocates for June 2nd, 1870, which is when Mrs. Howe issued that priest proclamation. But instead of having that argument, we'll spend the next few minutes here taking a closer look at some of the two stories. Because when they get both considered, it is often the contrasts that are noted. The peace and social justice activist Julia Ward Howe attempting to rally mothers to a good and righteous cause, versus the kind of gushy, mushy flowers and cards holiday that's grown out of Anna Jarvis's desire to honor her mother. That's kind of a surface interpretation. You dig a little bit below that, and you see that that's really too superficial, and you see that it's a false dichotomy. It's also interesting to note that Miss Jarvis, the younger, in the final years before her death in 1948, became very frustrated, and she became very disillusioned with what had happened to the holiday that she worked so hard to bring about. For her objective had been not just to honor her mother for being a mother, critically important as that was to her, but it was to also honor her for her humanitarian efforts and her reconciliation efforts in those little West Virginia communities where she lived. The daughter, Anna, saw in her mother an example and an inspiration for how, even in a very small and obscure part of the world, one could work for the common good. Miss Jarvis, in fact, became so upset with the commercialization of what she regarded as her holiday that she once referred to Mother's Day cards as, quote, a poor excuse for the letter you are too lazy to write. I guess I should do a full disclosure here and say I did send my mother a card this week, as I've done on every Mother's Day that I can remember. And I also even emailed her a Mother's Day greeting this morning, and I'll probably call her a little later today. I will call her a little later today. Which maybe this Jarvis would accept as the letter I'm too lazy to write. I guess I'll never know for sure. Be all that as it may, here's the common message I take from these two stories. On this Mother's Day of 2006, both Julia Ward Howe and the elder Anna Jarvis were very loving and devoted mothers to their children, for which they and all such mothers deserve recognition and respect. In Mrs. Jarvis's case, her love and devotion was accompanied by the deep pain of losing several of her children in their early years, a pain that no parent should have to experience, even though tragically many did. And devoted and loving mothers that they were, neither Mrs. Howe nor Mrs. Jarvis let themselves be completely defined by their role as a mother. They each had a larger vision, a larger passion, a larger commitment, that certainly encompassed their being a mother as well as looking beyond it for whatever greater good they could accomplish for the greater human family, of which they and all of us are a part. Now, because of her social standing, because of her access to some of the upper reaches of the society and the culture in which she lived, Julia Ward Howe could command a larger hearing. She could gain a greater response for her efforts. She could issue a proclamation and have it heard and printed and widely distributed so people would rally to her cause. She was, after all, Julia Ward Howe, author of The Battle Hymn of the Republic, a matriarch of a well-to-do, prestigious, and well-connected Boston family, and moved in a certain kind of social circles. So she did good, where she could, with the resources she had. And she's to be honored and praised on this day and on all days for using the station in life she had for the greater good of humanity when it comes to advocating and advancing the causes of peace and justice. Now, consider the elder Mrs. Anna Jarvis. Mrs. Anna Jarvis. She did not have the platform, or the standing, or the prestige that Julia Ward Howe did. She was a minister's wife, and the mother of their 12 in all children, in several small Appalachian villages in the mid to late 19th century. And she used what station in life she had in those little towns to bring about some measure of healing and health and some measure of reconciliation within them. In other words, like Julia Ward Howe, she did good where she could with the resources that she had. And we only know of her goodness because of the daughter who bore her name and who did not want to see her mother's deeds fade into obscurity. And I think in a very real sense, the elder Anna Jarvis represents all those deeds of kindness and compassion and concern that women render in the communities in which they live and work, and in the case of mothers raise and care for their children. Such deeds are scarcely noticed beyond the people directly affected by them, but they are very important nonetheless. And finally, both Julia Ward Howe and Mrs. Anna Jarvis drew upon the foundations, drew upon the principles of their faith communities and traditions, finding inspiration and the guidance that they sought in doing their good works. They were both women of faith. For Julia Ward Howe, it was the sermons and the teachings of her Unitarian minister, the Reverend Theodore Parker, who portrayed Jesus as a radical social reformer of his day. This is where Mrs. Howe took her cue for her own social reform efforts. And I have to say, I know considerably less, actually I know nothing, about the Methodist theology and preaching of Reverend Granville Jarvis. I know that he didn't get it at Harvard, as the Reverend Parker did. None of those Appalachian mountain preachers did at that time. So I can only guess that in the stories of how Jesus took his ministry of teaching and healing and compassion for the common, struggling, underclass folk of his day, perhaps it was there that Mrs. Jarvis took her cue for her own work with the common and struggling folk of her day and in the communities where she lived. desire that we should all be striving towards in whatever great or small ways we can, using whatever means or resources are available to us. This is the vision we should be setting before our children, whether they be biological children or children whose lives we are given the opportunity to influence in some way. For in this latter sense, we all have kids. We all have our chances to have an impact upon the generations that come of age after us. So as we seek out those opportunities, as we act on those kinds of responsibilities, I would ask we also keep in mind the words of our closing hymn. It's number 318, We Would Be One.